Net Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Bill Butts, and he'll be answering your most important questions on wild white bass. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Bill a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address on the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Bill Butts about wild white bass. Women's fly fishing in Alaska is owned and operated by well-known female guide Pudge Kleinclaw. Women's fly fishing offers several lodge-based fly fishing schools for women, as well as an array of small group-guided trips for women and couples to some of Alaska's best-known waters for salmon, rainbow trout, Arctic grayling, and char. Pudge also leads saltwater fly fishing groups to Mexico each spring. Beginners are welcome, and equipment is provided. Learn more about fly fishing for women at www.womensflyfishing.net. That's www.womensflyfishing.net. Or call Pudge at 907-274-7113. That's 907-274-7113. Before we introduce Bill, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have two chances to win tonight in a drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Bill's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a $20 gift certificate, and that gift certificate is courtesy of Front Range Anglers in Boulder, Colorado. And that gift certificate can be redeemed either in their store or online in their online store. So here's how you win that gift certificate. You must be one of the first people to answer the question we ask at the end of the show, and the question will be about something that Bill and I talk about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location using that text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills, and maybe you'll win that $20 gift certificate. Bill Butts began his 40-year journey in the sport and art of fly fishing on small lakes and trout streams in the Missouri and Arkansas Ozarks. He has fly fished across the U.S. and Canada for many species, including trout, largemouth, and smallmouth bass, crappie, and perch species, salmon and steelhead, muskies, northern pike, and walleye, blue sharks, and his favorite, the temperate basses, hybrid, striped, and white bass. Many years ago, he was fortunate to have become friends with many of the fly fishing industry leaders that willingly mentored him in the skills of fly casting, fly tying, and photography. Dave Whitlock and Lefty Cray are credited with being the most influential. Bill strives to share his passion and enthusiasm for fly fishing with newcomers to the sport and anyone who requests his help. He firmly believes the sharing attitude that permeates this great sport is the very foundation of what makes it so great. Bill has contributed several web articles on fly fishing for temperate basses on fly shop websites, including Fly Masters of Indianapolis, and that's www.flymasters.com, and Mountain River Fly Shop in Arkansas. You'll find that at www.mtnriverflyshop.com. A selection of PowerPoint-based programs on the popular temperate basses, from a simple springtime fly fishing for white bass program to a comprehensive program covering all three of the primary temperate bass species, has been developed, which he presents to interested fly shops, fly fishing clubs, and at fly fishing events. He also has a book and instructional DVD in development on the subject of fly fishing for temperate basses, but they are both still in their infancy stages. Bill, thanks for joining us, and welcome back to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thank you, Roger. It's great to be back.
Well, good to have you. How's that book and DVD coming along?
Well, you know, the key phrase there is in their infancy stages, and that really is the true thing. Seems like every time I start to write a section of that, then more questions pop up, and I feel like I need to research it further, so it's going to be a long process. I want to do it right.
Well, we're still waiting, Bill. We'll keep waiting, and okay. Just let us know. I'm sure it'll be a great hit out there because there's, you know, lots of interest in the Pinford Bassa, so we'll look forward to it. Well, let's see here. We're going to talk about white bass. Now, last time we talked with you about freshwater stripers.
Yeah.
So this time we're going to move off that a little bit, but kind of all in the same family here somewhat. So why don't we start out with talking about just what is a white bass and what is its relationship to stripers?
Well, Roger, I think that most people are familiar with striped bass, whether it be freshwater or saltwater, and they are, you know, they have some diverse history differences. But the white bass is a member of the temperate bass family, or what's also known in the fisheries realm as true basses, which might be kind of a surprise for those who pursue largemouth, smallmouth, the real, what most people call true basses. The temperate bass family includes white bass, hybrid striped bass, and striped bass, as well as just a few other minor relatives. But the white bass itself is a native of all of the Mississippi River drainage or watershed, which includes many tributaries, but including the Cumberland River, the Tennessee River, Missouri River, Illinois River, Ohio River, the White River, the Red River. That's kind of jumping from north to south, but all those are part of the Mississippi River drainage and tributaries, and the white bass is truly what they call a riverine fish, R-I-V-E-R-E-N-E, I believe is right. And in their origin, they were just a river fish, and most people know them today as a lake fish that also inhabit many rivers in the spring and sometimes all year, but their real background and history is as a river fish in freshwater.
Okay, okay. And so they're in the family of stripers. Now, the hybrid, some people call them wipers. So is a wiper a cross between a white bass and a striper?
It is, and I think I'm not sure we covered any of that because you had another guest on that particular topic, but of course, the striped bass is the largest cousin in the family of the temperate basses, but is a saltwater fish, mostly from the northeast coast from Maine clear down to Florida and across part of the Gulf Coast. And that is its native habitat, but it was adapted in freshwater, and that's a long story, part of it which we covered in the previous broadcast. But it was crossed back in the 60s, I believe it was the early 60s, in South Carolina, with a white bass, and it was coined the palmetto bass, and I believe South Carolina, something about its history or emphasis, they call it the palmetto state or something like that, so it was called the palmetto bass, but it was successfully bred and continues to be in many states across the country today and stocked in countless reservoirs and lakes very successfully, but that's kind of another topic,
sure,
you know,
sure.
But that is a success story from a fisheries and fisheries biologist standpoint. The white bass itself is a very, very successful, largely almost non-managed fish. And I've had more than one fisheries biologist tell me that from their standpoint, it's almost the perfect game fish because they don't have to stock it. They may introduce it in some fisheries, but they're very easy to introduce. They spawn very prolifically. They grow well. You know, they're not a huge game fish, but they are a very important game fish in literally hundreds, probably thousands of reservoirs and lakes in this country today.
Now, you said that they are a native fish to the Mississippi River drainage.
They are.
And Do you know if they exist anywhere else in the world, or is it just river drainage?
Honestly, I've never researched the white bass itself outside of North America, and specifically within the 48 contiguous states. I'm not aware that there are any white bass in Alaska, but I would plead ignorance on that because I've never researched. I've just never heard or read of anything about that, nor south of the border. Just because
how far
of it,
north? Do you know how far north they go up into the Mississippi?
Mississippi river drainage includes part of Minnesota, and
right.
I'm not sure about it would be part of Wisconsin too, but there's also another cousin fish up there called the yellow bass, which is a smaller cousin to the white bass, but it actually is a very beautiful fish. It's just smaller and averages probably a half pound to a pound in size, but still very similar in proportion, symmetry, and looks. I think a lot of people might look at those and say they've caught a white bass. But those are all fish in that Mississippi River drainage.
Hey, Dan in North Dakota wants to know, where are they? We just answered that for him. How do you catch them? We're going to answer that for him. But his third part of his question is, why would you try anything other than carp or bullheads that swim in the same kind of water? I don't know.
Run that by me again, if you would.
Sure,
run that by me again, Roger.
He basically wants to know why you would fish for white bass over, you know, other fish like carp, or he mentions bullheads. I don't know anybody that fishes for bullheads with flies, but maybe people do. I don't know. But he's just kind of asking why whitefish, I guess.
Well, did you say North Dakota or South Dakota?
He's in North Dakota.
Okay. Well, I'm not familiar with North Dakota, any of the fisheries up there. I am familiar with some of the range of the white bass in South Dakota, and people who actually fish up there, live up there, or visit that area. And it's, again, it's very prolific up there. But a white bass, I think you have to look at the characteristics of how they hit or strike, if you want to call it, how they fight. And some people would say, well, they're a great fish to clean and eat and that kind of thing. And I think they're good. They're not maybe at the top of the list. But for me, this is a personal thing, but temperate bass, including the white bass, for its size, say from 1 pound to 3 or 4 pounds, are just a tremendous game fish because of those reasons. The way they strike, they're very aggressive. The way they fight when you hook them, it's a really great experience, and it's a very available experience to thousands of fly fishermen, or, you know, all types of fishermen, but certainly fly fishermen in about the middle third or maybe 40% of the country. Not that they're not coast to coast, but that middle 30 to 40% of the country is really blessed to have many opportunities for these fish.
Sure. I think, you know, there's a bigger trend nowadays of fly fishers moving to warm water species, including carp. We just did a show with Barry Reynolds on carp, and, you know, he's catching a 38-pound carp in downtown Denver in the Platte River, you know. You know, you go a few minutes from your house if you live in Denver and you're catching trophy fish, you know. So I think, you know, warm water presents opportunities that might be closer to home for many people, and, you know, it's not all about trout, you know. And I think there's a bigger trend towards that nowadays. I just hear a lot more guys and gals talking about, you know, fishing for warm water species.
That's a really great point. And, of course, Barry is very well respected in the world of fly fishing. And when you talk about emphasis on catching any other species besides trout in the state of Colorado, which is the number one trout fishing state in the country, then when you have people who adopt that attitude of what you just said, of other opportunities, whether it's carp or white bass, or, of course, wiper, hybrid striper fishing in Colorado is gaining momentum due to several individuals and guides who have really promoted it and made it available and taught people. But if people in that state, and I hadn't really thought about this, but people in that state are embracing that as an alternative that they really get excited about, then that tells you that they really are opening their mind to the world of what's available to fly fish for and not just where do I go to catch trout.
Right, right. How big do white bass get?
I would say, Roger, that overall that the range that most people catch an adult white bass is from about 1 pound to 3 pounds. And I'm sure that there are many fisheries where the average size is less or the range is maybe more like a half a pound to maybe a pound and a half to 2 pounds. Where I live in southern Missouri, and I've talked to a lot of fishermen around the country, but I think that the area that we live in there, and I'm not bragging, I'm just stating facts, I've never found an area or even one specific fishery where we have, or any fishery has, the growth through the lifetime or the life cycle of the white bass that we have in southern Missouri. There are a couple of fisheries there that fish, I wouldn't say commonly reach 4 pounds, but about a year and a half ago, there was a world record fish caught in southern Missouri on a fly. And there were a few, I would say more than a few, several fish caught that I'm aware of, and probably many more, that were in the 4 pound plus to 5 pound plus range. And those are very large white bass.
Yeah, that's a nice fish to hook up with wherever you are. So
I think that a lot of people would not believe that those are white bass. They might say, well, those were wipers or hybrid stripers. But in these two particular fisheries, they don't stock those fish. It's just white bass. And I know people who have fished that for 40 years and will tell you that on a cyclical basis, that periodically every 6 to 10 years, you get 2 or 3 year classes of fish or maybe just 1 year class of fish periodically that are very, very large. And those are exceptional white bass, yes.
Now, the bass that are in the lakes then are, unless there's an incoming river, have been planted there, I take it. There's a lot of lake fishing for white bass down in Texas. So,
you mentioned Texas. Are you talking specifically about Texas? Or?
Well, in general, lakes that have white bass, are they generally stocked fish at that point and then reproduce on their own potentially?
Well, they are, yes. I don't know of a lot of very elaborate or highly prolific hatchery operations that deal with white bass. I'm not familiar with them. Where I live, and I'm familiar with the fisheries in Missouri, Arkansas, Oklahoma, Kansas primarily, and then a little bit less as you go out from there, those fish have been so well established for so many years that they are very self-perpetuating and truly wild fish. As you, I think, kind of coined the name of the program, Wild White Bass, and I've never really thought about that, but they truly are wild fish. They are native to this range, or to the region, if you will, and they are wild fish because they are not stocked on any remote kind of regular basis like a lot of put-and-take trout fisheries.
Okay, okay. Well, Bill, we need to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk more about wild white bass.
Okay.
Bear Marquette River Lodge, a full-service Orvis-endorsed lodge, fly shop, and guide service, located on the banks of the historic Bear Marquette River in Baldwin, Michigan. Bear Marquette River Lodge provides year-round lodging for the business or pleasure traveler, as well as a full-service fly shop and guided trips for steelhead, salmon, or large resident brown trout. For more information, visit them at www.pmlodge.com. That's pmlodge.com, or call 231-745-3972. That's 231-745-3972. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Bill Betts about wild white bass. If you'd like to ask Bill a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. So, Bill, before we jump back into the questions here, what have you been up to in the fly fishing world lately?
Well, as many people know, my emphasis and my passion has been on tempered bass, white bass, hybrid striped bass, and striped bass for a number of years now. And what I have done over the last almost 10 years is really focus just on those fish on a 12-month basis And there are certainly in the winter fewer opportunities than there are for, say, trout fishing, where, you know, cold water is a good thing, and spring-fed rivers and that kind of thing, tailwaters, have 12-month trout fishing very commonly and very, very good fishing. But I really have this passion for the temperate basses, and are in my region, which, as I mentioned before, was Missouri, Arkansas, Oklahoma, Kansas, a little bit in Illinois, and reaching out occasionally from these states. Now, I really seek to learn more and more to understand these fish, because there's not a lot in writing about them. There's not a lot of research about them. And I spend a lot of time researching them as well as on the water. So it's been a very, very interesting learning process, and having a background in both trout fishing and in warm water fishing for bass, smallmouth, panfish, all with fly, it has been a very interesting challenge, I guess you would say, because it is very, very different. But yet it's so available to so many fishermen in this country. The white bass, which is the most available of the temperate basses, and certainly the hybrids or wipers, as most people call them, and stripers in freshwater, many, many opportunities for fly fishermen. I'm really trying to break that down and to share information with people as I learn that, and ultimately try to compile that, put it in some semblance of a book and maybe even a DVD at some point, to help people really understand and be successful at catching these fish with flies.
Well, good. Great. We all appreciate your efforts in trying to dig deeper into these fish, for sure, for sharing it with us like you are now. It's great. Well, you mentioned just now, you know, 12-month exploration, so to speak, of this species. And Tim Bear in Central Illinois, which you just mentioned as well, asks, what's the best time of year to try to catch white bass on the fly? So could you kind of talk about, you know, the different seasons, and maybe even talk about, you know, their migration habits and so forth along with that?
Sure. Sure. I think that when it comes to white bass, that most people who have caught a lot of white bass, let's say, and that doesn't mean just fly fishermen, but whether they're bait fishermen or gear fishermen or fly fishermen, I think that most of those people, most of those fishermen would say that their emphasis in the times that they have caught the most white bass is in the spring, related somehow to the spawning run. And depending on where you are, whether it's the deep south to the Great Plains or somewhere in between, that can be anywhere from as early as early March to early to mid-May. But that is all related to pre-spawn, the spawning run from lakes up into tributaries and tailwater fisheries. And that really is where you have a lot of emphasis on all types of fishing techniques for white bass.
Okay, so the spring is one of the best times of year. Kind of walk us through the year then, and if spring is the best, you said it had to do with spawning. Where are they? Are they then up in the tributaries? Are they in the shallows? Where are they doing their spawning?
Yeah, let me just kind of give you maybe close to a 12-month calendar, and we're going to talk about maybe the south central U.S., Arkansas, again, you've heard me say this, Arkansas, Oklahoma, Missouri, Kansas. In the late winter, which I would call maybe as early as late February and certainly into the month of March, we call that the pre-spawn period for white bass. And white bass that are in an impoundment, a reservoir, a lake, whatever you want to call it, during that period of time in the winter, gradually they migrate to the mostly upper ends or toward the tributaries of those particular fisheries, those lakes and reservoirs. And once the water temperatures gradually warm up, and we're going to talk about early spring, early spring, late winter, high 40s to low to mid 50 degree temperatures, those fish are continuing to feed, but they are gravitating toward those tributaries. Does that make sense?
Sure.
Okay. So then as the temperature passes the 55 degree point, and that's an approximate temperature, and it can vary with the fishery, but as you get to that mid 50 range, those fish really start to move into the tributaries, not just the mouths of the tributaries, but up into the moving water. And of the white bass species, the males of the white bass will move up into the river first. And sometimes they'll move up quite a ways, a mile, 2, 3, 4 miles. And that is kind of a pre-spawn period where they continue to feed as all of temperate bass do, whether it's white bass or any of the others. They will continue to feed, unlike other species in the fish world, up until literally the time that they begin to spawn, the hour that they begin to spawn. But they will move up into a river, they will feed, sometimes they move back, and it's very water temperature driven. 2, 3, 4 degrees can make a huge difference. So this can be kind of a yo-yo effect, up and down, for literally weeks. Until you get into, and these are kind of approximate general times, but very early April, all the way as late as early to mid-May, depending on the latitude of where you are in the country, the males will stay up there at some point because water temperature begins to stabilize a little more, and they're getting ready for the females to join them, and the female white bass will come in once the water temperature exceeds the mid-50 degree range. They will begin to spawn as, and there may be exceptions to this, but I don't know it, in the very high 50s, 58 to 59 or 60 degrees, and above 60 degrees, the white bass, the females, are ready to spawn. A small group of males will join one female white bass, and they will spawn. The females will not stay in that river system nearly as long as the males. There are some variables on that. Water temperature driven. I believe water clarity driven, because they're open ranging, what a lot of people would call pelagic fish, open water fish. They're used to roaming and ranging over great expanses of water. They get up into smaller bodies of water, rivers, streams, even creeks. They're just not quite as comfortable. If that water has a little color to it, or even muddy, they will have a tendency to stay there for more days or even weeks, but that's not spawning driven. It's driven by the opportunity to maybe feed. So,
what's the depth of the river that, you know, when they're up there in the spawning stage, how deep are they?
Well, they can be a great variety, and give you an example. There's a creek not probably in 45 minutes from where I live that I fished only a few times in, maybe it was 2 or 3 years ago. I'd never been there. It was very shallow in most places. It was very narrow, but because it was a high water year, that created that opportunity, and more of those fish came out of the lake and went further up in that little creek. That won't happen every year. But you get a large tributary, like the, trying to think of an example, and I can't think of one offhand that everybody would identify with, but you take a river that flows good volume, you know, it's maybe a 100 to 200 feet across on average, just good flow. Those rivers will have excellent numbers of fish up in them every single year. If it's a high water year and they're way up, even more fish, and they go up further and further and there's more fish. In low water years, they will stay a little closer to the lake and maybe not range quite as far up the tributaries as they do in higher water years. So there are a lot of variables there, and that may sound a little sketchy, but that's the way those fish are. They're very fickle. They're very temperature and water condition driven, water clarity, water temperature, water volume. There's just so many variables that it's very difficult.
Okay, there's not like a preferred depth of water they like to spawn in, for instance. You know, when salmon are spawning, they get into very shallow water. back sticking out. And they seem to like that.
Sure.
Is that the same kind of situation here, or do they?
It's really not. It's more of a function of the, and that's a really good question, although it doesn't have a lot to do with catching white bass, but from the characteristics of their spawning habits, what they look for is very good oxygenated water over clean gravel. Whether the water is 2 feet deep or 10 feet deep, it really doesn't matter, because what they do is that female, when she comes in there, is ready, she will be in the upper 2 feet of the water column, again, whether it's 2 or 3 feet deep or 10 feet deep.
Okay.
And,
what I was getting at is, and you just said it really doesn't make any difference, but what I was getting at is, when these fish are moving upstream, like, for instance, the males first and then the females, I'm thinking, well, they're coming out from deeper water into more shallow water, which could give you a better opportunity to target them, fly, rather than, you know, open water in a lake or reservoir. So is this migration movement up into the tributaries, is that the prime time for targeting the fish?
Well, it is because of concentrations of fish, and to move more from the spawning characteristics and discussion to where you would target those fish, you really have to kind of shift that discussion. And what I always tell people is that you want to look for areas, let's say you have a river, and this is hypothetical but very realistic too, let's say you have a river that's 100 feet across, but you know, most of the flow is in half of that, so it's easy to cover as far as casting. What you want to look for is some depth and a break in the current, the edge of currents, little back eddies, that kind of thing. White bass don't like to stay in the heaviest current in the river. They will move through it, but they won't sit in it. They might feed in it temporarily. They might move up and through it to another quieter area, but you want to catch them on the edge of currents. So back eddies, or what we call pockets or eddies, they will accumulate fish. They will stack up in those kinds of areas, and that's a good area to target them. Again, this is in the spring when they're on their spawning run. And so those eddies could be 2 or 3 feet deep. They could be 10 to 15 feet deep, depending on the size and depth of the river. Does that make sense?
Okay. Sure. Now, are they moving, and kind of address this to open water, too. Do they normally move in schools in open water, and are they moving in schools as they migrate up to the spawn?
They do. From the standpoint of as they kind of migrate or move up into the tributaries to spawn, the males, as I mentioned before, will make their, they'll move up in, they'll feed, they'll kind of come back, up and back out of the tributaries, and a lot of that's based on water temperatures, because early in the year, cold fronts, warm fronts can make that water temperature fluctuate several degrees. But they do move in groups. I don't know that they're in real tight schools, but I still think that they orient to groups. Once you get into the really closer to the spawning time, when the females move up into the river, then they begin to isolate, and I think that gets to be a discussion that maybe is not totally necessary. I think it's fascinating because I've watched it for so many years. But from the standpoint of really targeting those fish to catch the fish, the time is when they're at a stable and critical time for fishermen is when the water temperatures stabilize, whether that be early in the season when water temperatures are generally cool, but when they stabilize for 2 or 3 or 4 days and get kind of comfortable in that area and stay where you can target them, or whether it's a little later in the spring when the night temperatures are warm, the water temperatures don't fluctuate as much, and they will stay up in those tributaries for an extended period of time. We're talking days to weeks, and you can really pinpoint them and target them in the areas like I was talking about. Back eddies, edges of current where there's a little depth where they can kind of lay down in there. But
what happens to them if they're in a lake or reservoir where there are no tributaries? Do they have the same spawning, the same kind of activity? Do they go into the shallows or something? Does that present an opportunity?
Well, I don't know how many of those situations with reservoirs there really are with the area and the region that I described that I fish. We have tributaries, and from a spawning run standpoint in the spring, it's all tributary driven. Now, I am aware that there is discussion about whether it's stripers or white bass, if they have a particular type of reservoir where the tributaries are tiny. I mean, and all reservoirs have some kind of tributary, but if they're very, very small and not a lot of flow to them, and particular in low water years, I think there's a question that has been discussed over years as well, what do they do if it's a very, very low water year, or if you have such tiny tributaries that it really doesn't provide access for a lot of fish to move out. I've heard them say that white bass or stripers will spawn on windswept shallow points where you have clean gravel, but yet you get sort of a current flow because of a lot of wind, say in a state like Kansas or western Oklahoma, where you just have a lot of wind almost constantly. You get that oxygenated water going across shallow water. I can't really speak to that because it certainly makes sense, but I've never experienced, and I don't know how successful those fish really are at spawning in those kind of conditions. So I can't really speak to that, Roger.
Okay. Let's move on to, after the spring spawn, then we're going into summer. What's our summer fishing like for the striped bass? Where will we find them?
Well, for white bass, as they move back out of tributaries in the late spring, again, I want to kind of make a distinction. These fish, whether it's a striper or a white bass, they will feed opportunistically, whether it's on shad or crawfish or river minnows. They will feed actively as they want to up until literally the hour that they begin the spawning mode, if you will. That's not the case with every fish species, so that's a little bit different. But once they return to the reservoir or lake where they came out of, then there is a pretty active feeding period where they are very aggressive in these lakes and reservoirs. And what I always tell people in kind of general terms is that you need to look for windy points, windy flats, where the wind has hopefully been blowing for 2 to 3 or 4 days into the same flat. Now, in most of these fisheries, the forage that those fish are looking for is either gizzard or threadfin shad. And those shad are plankton feeders. They don't feed on other little bait fish or anything like that. They're literally straining microorganisms, plankton, out of the water through their gill rakers, and sun blooms that. I may have not laid the groundwork for this, but the windy side of a lake, if it's blown in the same direction for an extended period of time, accumulates that bloom of microscopic plankton. You can't see it, but those shad migrate or orient to that. And whether it be white bass or stripers or wipers, they are going to orient to the bait fish, to those forage fish. So where the shad go or the blueback herring, in the southeast and south where those exist, which is also a shad is a herring species, where they go, the temperate bass will follow. So it's a cause and effect thing, and they're never very far from those shad or herring.
Do they get into, the shad and herring are schooling fish, so you usually find a bunch of them together, correct?
That's correct. Both the herring species and the temperate bass species are what they call pelagic fish. They're open water fish, whether it be in the ocean, like with stripers, or with white bass in reservoirs. They are considered pelagic species, which are open water roamers. So they are constantly seeking those bait fish. And if you have a very large school of hundreds or thousands of whether it's white bass or stripers, they have to have a lot of bait fish, a lot of shad, a lot of blueback herring, whatever it happens to be, to satisfy their appetite. Does that make sense?
Sure.
Okay.
So find bait fish, find the white bass, and or some of these other temperate bass as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Act in a similar fashion. Okay, hold on just a second. I'm going to take a quick break, and then we'll come back and talk more about wild white bass. Flatstein Charters is your sponsor for this segment of the show. Captain Bob Jaspers of Flatstein Charters will introduce you to the Mosquito Lagoon, Indian River, and No Motor Zone of the Banana River on the east coast of Central Florida. Only a short drive from Orlando, you will sight fish for big redfish, spotted sea trout, and black drum, as well as the seasonal snook and tarpon. Captain Bob is a lifetime resident of the area and has chosen his knowledge of the local fish, flora, and fauna. Call Flatstein Charters now and arrange your next memorable adventure. You can reach Captain Bob Jaspers at 321-631-4051. That's 321-631-4051. Or go to his website at flatstein.com. That's FLATSTIME.com. Flatstein.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Bill Butts about wild white bass. If you'd like to ask Bill a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as on the show tonight as possible. Well, Dan Crowler's up in North Dakota, off the rope back, and he said he was being facetious about the bullheads, I guess, but he does say that, but now, Dan, you will be known as the fly fisher who seeks bullheads, and we're going to pass that reputation around, so, for playing with me. Anyway, so Dan Bullhead Crowlers, he said there are a lot of fish, white bass, up in his area. The Missouri River is near where he lives, and there are reservoirs on the river both north and south of where he lives. Both have white bass. And he wants to know more about still, you know, fishing them on still waters, flies and so forth. So we're going to get into that right now. But I just wanted to kind of clear the air there about Dan and the bullheads. So,
I caught a lot of bullhead catfish when I was a kid, so I wouldn't put anybody down or doubt their pursuit of any species with a fly rod.
Actually, one of my best memories is with my grandfather in the Menominee River in Wisconsin. We go out at midnight and fish with bait and bottom for bullheads and catch about 100 of them and come back and clean them and freeze them and then have a fish fry. So that was one of my really early childhood memories with bullheads. But anyway, so, okay, so in the summertime, we're looking for them in the white bass out in the open water, Windy Point, places where the plankton's concentrating and so forth. Now, and then as we move into... And I want to get into specific strategies here in a minute, but kind of whip us through the fall here and where they are moving then and take us back to the winter on how these fish move around them.
Oh, okay, yeah, we kind of need to get back to that. From the late spring, and in my region that is mid to late May, through, at least late October, but sometimes as early as the 1st of December, that is a period of time where white bass, or literally any temperate bass, they roam the lakes and reservoirs from the depths to the shallows, almost constantly moving, not 100%, but almost constantly moving in pursuit of forage. And again, going back to the example of most of these reservoirs have either threadfin or gizzard shad or both, or blueback herring and a few other species, that's really what they're oriented to. And the temperate bass species are not the only ones. Crappie, walleye, all of the main bass species, they all orient to these forage-based foods, which I think a lot of people maybe think they're more oriented to other things like crawfish and bluegill and small crappie and those kind of things. But in the man-made impoundments in this country these days, they're so dominated by bait fish species of the shad, well, really the herring species, shad of gizzard and threadfin shad and blueback herring and some others. They are just an incredible, important group of fishes or group of forage for these species that it can't be overemphasized.
Okay, then what happens in October?
Okay, in October and even depending on your latitude, certainly into November, and I've experienced it into mid-December, even in my latitude in southern Missouri, you will still find fish when the water temperature remains stable and you have windy points and windy flats. You'll find those temperate bass, white bass, stripers, hybrids, herding these bait fish into points and flats and attacking them, and those are the areas. Now, you can use, if you have the electronic gear on a boat, you can certainly find them, but those are the places that they usually show up. And if the wind has been blowing in the same direction for 2, 3, 4, 5 days, you're almost certain to find them on the windward side, the windy side of those points and flats. And
is it just that they are moving deeper but come up at periods of time and they're kind of...
Well, water temperature drives that to a great extent, but once the water temperatures get back down in the, certainly below the 50, low 50s to 50 or less water temperature, then those shad, again, the predatory fish, the temperate bass, are going to be oriented to the forage. If those shad sense that this is a little too cool, we're going to go deeper, find some warmer water. The predatory fish are going to go there also. So once you get to that point, whether it's late fall or early winter, then the depths increase, and most people who are successful for these fish during that period of time are going to be fishing somewhere in the 15 to 30 foot depths. And from a fly fishing standpoint, that begins to be challenging. It's certainly possible, but it's not nearly as common or enjoyable.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk a little bit about equipment. We have, from the internet, we've got Nick in Brookfield, Wisconsin, and also Jim Scheel in Marietta, Georgia. I want to know more about what kind of rod, weight, and length you prefer. Why don't you talk about reels, too, if there's anything specific?
Okay. I think in the importance of tackle, the important factors are very first lines, fly lines, and leaders, and then the rod and then the reel in that order, and I'll kind of explain that. If a fishery has just white bass, and most people can tell you that, if you're not familiar with the fishery, if someone says, well, there's nothing but white bass in that fishery, or whatever it happens to be, some fisheries have white bass, hybrid stripers, and stripers, then you need to kind of be aware of that, but let's take it a step at a time. If it's just a white bass fishery, what I tell people is that if you have a rod, and I like a 9-foot rod for most fisheries, that's a 6 weight, but a pretty fast, let's call it fast to extra fast tip, fast action rod. A 6-weight will work pretty well. A 7-weight for most people is probably the best overall, but a 6-weight can do pretty good. Now, I'm qualifying that by saying that if that is also a lake that has hybrids or stripers or both, then the opportunity to hook one of those fish and possibly a very good fish, you know, a double-digit hybrid or striper, you don't want to blow that opportunity, so I wouldn't fish a 6-weight in a fishery like that. I'd fish at least a 7-weight. But what I really advise people to do is to have a rod that's a fast-action rod, and if you're kind of a novice at this sport, fast-action means basically stiff. A rod doesn't flex a lot, but there are quite a few rods that don't flex a lot except at the very end of the tip, the last 24 or 12 to 24 inches. And for the kind of fishing and flies and lines that we use in this particular type of fishing, you need a rod that's got a fast or stiff tip. Okay? And the reason you need that is because of some factors. One is we use not just a floating line with a nice long leader that's very pleasant to cast. We're fishing flies that are sometimes bulky, wind or air resistant, heavy, lead eyes, chain eyes, that kind of thing. So that presents some casting challenges. We fish sink tip lines, sinking head lines, which means that the sinking section is anywhere from 10 to 30 feet or more in length. So there's some extra weight up front. And then you have the atmospheric factors of wind, which in a lot of places in this country, you have that factor. So a rod that is a little stiffer, specifically in the tip section, in the top third, top half of the rod, will allow you to control those factors better. And as much as I like, in my trout fishing days, I like slower, softer rods, I've just found that, within reason, the faster rods allow you more control, better casting accuracy and distance. So that's my suggestion. Regardless of brand or cost, if it's a good stiff tip rod, it's going to help you a lot in what you're doing.
Okay. You had mentioned lines, and Russell in Fort Wayne, Texas, asked, do you use a full sinking line system? You just said that lines are most important, so why don't you tell us how you rig up and what do you use?
Well, they really are, and this is a discussion that could be almost an hour in itself, but I'll try to condense this a little bit. Russell's question related to full sinking line system, and I think my thoughts on that are varied, and please try to follow me here because there are no hard and fast rules to this. But I have used literally dozens and experimented with dozens of types of lines, from floating and intermediate to the fastest sinking lines that really are realistic to cast on a rod that's a 6 to 8 weight rod. And what I tell people is if they're fishing, say, in the spring, where they're up in a river, a tributary that, again, we talked about this before, that could be a small stream, could be a pretty large river. But a lot of times those are not real deep. I really emphasize two types of sink rates. Again, I didn't say floating lines, but sink rates. A sink tip line, and a sink tip would be a 10 to 15 foot sinking section in the tip of a fly line that sinks at about 3 to 4 inches per second. A lot of people a lot of companies would call that a type 3, but if you look at their ratings on a fly line, 3 to 4 inches per second of sink is the key. And that's the most important line in the spring up in the tributaries to use. The secondary line, and I do use this a lot, is about double that rate, about 6 inches per second. But I usually use, either the 15-foot sink tip or a 25 to 30-foot sinking head section of approximately 5 to 6 inch per second sink rate. So that gives you two distinctively different sink rates. And my advice to people, my suggestion to people as a starting point is to have a sink tip that's 3 to 4 inches per second and a sinking head, 25 to 30 feet of sinking head, that is 5 to 6 inches per second. That gives you two very distinctively different lines, not only sink rates, but also the amount of line that is sinking, even if the flies you're fishing are the same. And that's very, very important. Now, again, I mentioned that I've used literally dozens of types of lines. In the spring, those are the two most important. Now, if you shift to the lake fishing from late spring to late fall, then there's a very wide variety of lines. Because if someone has fished, whether with a fly or with bait gear, spinning tackle, for these fish, or even for bass, they know those fish could be on the surface feeding. They could be on a windy point or flat at 2 to, say, 5 or 6 feet, or they could be a lot deeper than that. So the opportunities could be at various levels. So then you go from the possibility of having or needing a floating line for, say, a pencil popper, a creech fly, something that is worked on the surface or waking in the surface film, so to speak. Then you have the type 3, 3 to 4 inches per second that is going to carry you down to the 2 to 4 foot level. And then the 5 to 6 inches per second is going to be in your 4 to 6 foot, maybe even 7 foot level. So you're covering 3 different water column levels in the lake. And you can go deeper than that, but that covers 3 very important levels. Those can happen in the same day. So it gets a little confusing and complex sometimes, the person has the ability to rig multiple rods, that's great. If they don't, what they really need to do, if they want to be successful and increase their odds of success with these fish, is have one of those multi-tip sink tip lines or sinking head lines where you have loop-to-loop system, whether it happens to be a Rio system or a Scientific Angler system, where you can interchange the tips or the head links and fish at different levels without actually changing a spool or having another rod. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes a great idea.
Okay.
Because not everybody can afford multiple rigs.
Well, it is expensive, especially if you're just starting out.
Sure, sure. Well, Bill, we're going to take another quick break. We'll come right back, and we'll talk more about flies, strategy, and tactics. So hang in there, folks. Flat River Fly Shop in Casper, Wyoming, features a first-class website covering all aspects of fly fishing, the tailwaters of the North Platte River, including up-to-date local fishing reports, fly patterns, guide services, and online shopping for top-of-the-line gear for any travel destination. Flat River Fly Shop provides a professional guide staff for the Blue Ribbon, Trophy, Gray Reef, and Miracle Mile sections of the North Platte River. Visit their extensive website at www.wyotrout.com. That's wyotrout.com. Or call the Flat River Fly Shop at 307-237-5997. That's 307-237-5997. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Bill Butts about wild white bass. If you'd like to ask Bill a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Bill, several questions here on flies. We talked about what they eat, so we're going to try to simulate that, I suppose. And, Russell in Fort Worth, Texas, and Tim in Central Illinois all want to know, what are your top flies or what are your go-to flies for white bass?
Well, those are good questions, and those are always the most common questions when it comes to any species. But I always tell people that the plouser or deep minnow style flies have probably taken way more fish for me, whether it's white bass, hybrids, or stripers, than any other style of fly. And those can be tied out of or bought tied out of bucktail, you know, deer hair, or a synthetic hair of a variety of types. But I really want to emphasize, and I'm glad we spent the time on the topic of other things like the lines and kind of the background of the fish, because I really don't believe that the style of the fly is nearly as critical as locating the fish and understanding that you need to get the fly down, which means the fly line. Fly pattern is important, but it's not near the top in that. So having said that and kind of reinforced that, the Clouser style flies are my number one. And when it comes to white bass, I try to simplify this because they are not selective feeders. If I am, whether it's on a lake or on a river, if I know that I'm on fish, the pattern itself, if I can get it in front of, is not real critical. The color and where the fly is the most critical. So having said that, let's just say a lead-eyed Clouser-type fly. There's a fly called a Jiggy. I believe that's a Bob Popovich pattern. Even a small leadhead jig. They're all very, very effective. Now, I think color is extremely important. White bass don't have real large mouths, so you don't need a big fly. And, of course, they're not real large fish, but even a 2 or 3 pound fish, let's say if it was a largemouth bass, they can inhale a pretty good size lure or fly. White bass, you don't have to have a real big fly for them. So a fly that's anywhere from 1.5 inches or 2 inches up to 3 inches is probably about the right range. And in the colors, if you have clear water or relatively clear water, a white or gray and white or light blue and white, those are all good sort of neutral but visible patterns in that kind of water. Chartreuse and white or solid chartreuses, and it's just always a good fly. On a bright day in clear water, it's not my choice. I like more neutral patterns like a gray or even white or even a tan. But when you get into water that has some color to it, then visibility becomes more and more important. In other words, visibility of the fly to the fish, for them to locate that fly. And that's where I go to chartreuse and orange. In really murky or muddy water, the best visible pattern or color combination is chartreuse and black.
Okay.
If people get in, and this can be very effective to fishing at night, and this may be probably a little more in the spring in the spawning run, and I've fished a lot at night during that time, then you need a fly. In most cases, it's very dark. Any black, just a solid black. And flash makes no difference because you have no sunlight. But a solid black and a vivid purple is also good. But my understanding is that fish see purple as black, so I think black is the benchmark. Those are good colors. I think sometimes people get a little too hung up on intricate colors, color combinations. I think there was a question that you had somewhere that came in that was talking about how someone had done really great with pink.
Yeah, let me read that.
Okay.
Someone that goes by Fish and Wrench from Lake of the Ozarks in Missouri. He says, Bill, during the last spring run of the whites and hybrids, they showed a definite preference for pink. Pink plowsers, pink muddlers. Some days it didn't matter what you threw at them as long as it was pink and moving fast and erratic. Even after the water cleared up, pink was the code cracker. They couldn't get enough of it. Have you noticed specific color preferences like that in places you fish for whites or hybrids?
I think I've answered part of that question, that clear water, you can adjust to clear water and murky water. I happen to be familiar with that fishery there because it's not that far from where I live. Pink is a very good color because it's a visible color. It's not one of the absolute most visible colors, but it's a very visible color if the material has a good dye to it, and that's a whole nother subject. But I know lots of people, and I have certainly experienced it myself, who have fished pink, and it's very, very good.
Hmm.
I think it's one that you can kind of put in the category with chartreuse, maybe just a little step below chartreuse, but it's visible in lower light, in more difficult water clarity conditions. And I noticed that what you said about that, and I've got the question here in front of me, even after the water cleared up. So that meant that when he was originally fishing it, the water was not real clear.
Right.
And yes, and I know people that fish pink very religiously. A good friend who fishes red, and I don't fish red very often, but he fishes a solid red or red and white. Why does that work? I don't know. I think it's visibility partly, but I also think that with those fish, and we're talking in his case, the guy at the Lake of the Ozarks and my friend, where the fish are somewhat congregated, if you can catch them at the right time, get that visible fly in front of them, you're going to get a positive reaction. You're going to have success.
It's funny, of all the interviews that I've done now, and I think I'm up to, I think this is number 95 or 96, but that question keeps coming up, and it's always the why. In fact, even last week when we did a show on midges, we were looking at Pat Dorsey's box and Rick Takahashi's book, and it's probably 900 midges in this one box. All these different colors, but nobody that I know, out of all the fishermen that I've talked to, really has an answer for why the color, other than, you know, sometimes visibility. But even Kelly Gallup, when he's fishing, like, streamers in the Madison up there, you know, says, hey, if white's not working, then after 10 minutes, I'm switching to yellow. He says, I don't know why, but it makes a difference on different days. And nobody seems to have that answer. That's kind of the elusive answer out there in the fishing world is why they are on, and by the day, you know, having that color preference is very interesting.
Well, And nobody's ever been able to have a personal one-on-one interview with any species of fish. And so there's a lot of experience, a lot of research that goes into all that. And, you know, a lot of these companies, especially lure companies, you know, you look at the bass lure companies and striper lure companies and all that kind of thing. And gosh, the research that goes into that and what colors they produce their selection of lures in is quite incredible, and I didn't really realize that until the last several years. You know, I just always thought it was a selection, and I didn't realize there was so much research that went into that. But that's probably a whole nother show on itself, too.
Well, we have another question by Dave in Des Moines, Iowa. He says, have you ever tried, and you had mentioned this a few minutes ago, but maybe you can talk about it a bit more, but have you ever tried crease flies for white bass? And if so, what have been your most productive patterns and hook size, which I was going to ask you about, too? Style and size of hooks that you use for these clousers and so forth.
Sure. For anyone who is listening that doesn't know what a crease fly is, and it's a fly that has not been popular for all that long, a crease fly is a surface fly. It's a bait fish imitation that is basically a folded foam body tied on a hook that has generally a short tail, and it floats or wakes down in the surface of the water and creates a disturbance. It's an excellent fly. They catch everything from bass and white bass and stripers to many species of saltwater fish. It's a very well-known pattern. To answer the question, yes, I have used it with success. And with regard to white bass, when I like to use that, when I have the most success when it comes to surface action, is in probably the mid to late summer to early fall. And I'll explain that. During that period of time, you've got a lot of young of the year, in other words, newly hatched shad, whether they be threadfin shad, gizzard shad. These can be anywhere from a half inch long to 2 inches long in that period of time, depending on the species. And crease fly is a great imitation of the shad. Now, I've never fished a crease fly that was only an inch long, or probably the smallest one I ever fished was a couple inches long. But I've caught a lot of white bass and other species, black bass, Kentucky bass, that kind of thing, on small crease flies. And I will tell you the size based on the length of the fly, not the hook size. Because if someone's fishing tying a size 4, that could be 3 inches long. It could be an inch and a half long in total length. What a person needs to know, whether you're a fly tier or not, if you're buying flies or tying flies to fish for any species, when it comes to bait fish, fish can get selective, whether they be black bass or temperate bass or anything, they can get selective to size. Whether it's a grown shad or a young of the year shad or something in between. So I always ask people if they say, well, I did great on topwater. I say, well, that's great. What'd you catch them on? Well, I caught them on a spook. You know, it's a hard bait. Well, they make spook, and I think, is there a spook in 4 different sizes? So I always just say, well, what length was the bait? And they say 2 inches, you know, 3 inches, 6 inches, whatever it happens to be. That tells me what I have to fish with. Does that make sense?
Sure.
So with a crease fly, the smallest crease fly I have is probably 1¾ inches to 2 inches. And I've caught a lot of white bass, as well as black bass, smallmouth, Kentuckys, looking for surfacing, feeding fish that are chasing shad into shallows or pushing them up and busting into them over deep water. It's a very, very good fly. It's not the only fly, but that's a very, very good pattern.
Okay, we had another question come in on the Internet. Brian in South Carolina, he asked about minnow imitations, which we've just talked about, but he also asks about deer hair bugs, and like mouse patterns, that kind of thing, or terrestrials. Are those things...
Consequence? Well, I would say that you wouldn't ever want to totally rule out any pattern. But when it comes to white bass fishing or any of the temperate bass, they are very, very keyed on whatever the primary forage bait fish is in that fishery, whether it's one or both of the primary shad species that we talk about, you know, the threadfin shad or the gizzard shad, the blueback herring. You said he was in South Carolina?
Right, South Carolina.
And I believe you got all those. And, of course, those are all herring species, and they're all shaped about the same. They're kind of a slender, deep-bodied bait fish. But beyond that, certainly they will feed on other species. Crawfish is one of them, and I think they fish on crawfish more in rivers than they do in the lakes. So the rivers would be in the spring, unless it happens to be a tailwater. But that's pretty limited. I think a person needs to key on when it comes to any temperate bass species. They need to key on what the primary abundant forage fish is, and it's going to be one of those herring families, shad, blueback herring. And the main difference there then becomes is, okay, are they keying on one that's 1 inch long, 2 inches long, 4 inches long, whatever it happens to be. But with white bass, which are generally, you know, they don't generally exceed 3 pounds, they're not going to be after very large gizzard shad, you know, 4, 5, 6, 10, 12, 14 inches. They're going to be after the smaller versions of that or the blueback herring. So the white bass generally are going to have about a 1 to 3 inch fly.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about presentation strategies and so forth.
Okay.
You've pretty much given us a really good idea of where these fish are and why they are where they are, you know, following the bait fish and so forth. So give us and we're running short on time here, so you're going to have to be a little bit concise here with your answers. But
okay.
Talking about, and I think we've kind of identified two situations, the river situation and then the open water situation, the windy point, the following of the bait fish. Can you address those two situations and talk about, what your presentation strategies are during those times?
Okay. Let's talk about the spring first when they're up in the rivers. When those fish are in these holes and eddies and that kind of thing on current seams, what I like to do with the sink tip lines, again, kind of going back to when we were talking about tackle, let's just use the example of a weighted clouser style fly, a sink tip line, and we haven't talked about leaders, but I'm going to quickly say, with a sink tip or a full sink line or a sinking head line, I don't usually exceed 4 feet in total leader. And it's usually a two-piece leader, a butt section, loop-to-loop to a tippet section, 18 inches of butt section, 30 inches of tippet section, so about 4 feet. That way it allows it to sink. So, sink tip line, whether it's a medium sink, fast sink, and I like to cast it straight across a current and let it settle down into those eddies where you're in the slower water. And generally the strike will come in the swing or as you're retrieving back up through that eddy where they're in water that presents little resistance to them and they can hold in there comfortably. There will be bait fish in there of all types, whether it be shad or river minnows or whatever it is. That's just very, very common. So casting a cross current, letting it sink as it swings, and then a retrieve that is, we'll talk about retrieves a little bit here. Whether it be a lake or a river, if you're in water that is below 60 degrees, that's pretty cool to those fish. The retrieve needs to be slow, not erratic, so that the fish can track it. They're going to be a little more sluggish, a little more deliberate. As the water temperature increases, their metabolism is going to be higher. They're going to be more aggressive, and an erratic, very fast strip, long strips, erratic strips, they're going to track it. And when their metabolism is optimum, you cannot strip a fly too fast. Okay. Whether it's a striper or a white bass, you can't pull it away from one if they want to fly. So, colder water and dark or muddy water, when visibility is a factor, you want to slow it down and keep it sort of consistent so they can track a fly. When the water is clear, water temperature is optimum, again, above 60, 65 degrees. If they are really on it, you can't strip it too fast. That's not meaning they always want it that way. That just means that you can't strip it too fast. Let's see. Did we cover kind of that? Okay, that we're talking about in a river. That also applies to a lake in summer, late spring, summer, fall, because it's water temperature driven and water clarity driven. Does that make sense?
Sure.
Okay. I'm not sure I've answered the question totally. Help me out here.
Yeah. Going back to the river situation, you said you're fishing the eddies, so you're fishing across the river. So Are you throwing it into the back of the eddy and then letting it swing down through the eddy and coming back into the current? Is that kind of the...
I usually cast approach? Into the current and let it swing into the eddy, let
the
sink tip
okay.
line take it down before I actually start any kind of retrieve, and then it
work
is
it up the lar- seam, kind of.
I'm sorry?
And then work it up the seam, basically. Kind of.
Yes.
Into the slower water.
Well, yeah. right on the current edge or off of it in the slower water.
Okay. I just want to clear that up. And then as you, like you said, in the lake, of course you're not working with the currents or the eddies, so you're just trying to find this fish, find the water column, and
mm-hmm.
then just vary your script, trying to try different things. If one thing doesn't work, then you try a little bit different pace or length of strip, I take it.
Yes, and I always tell people, don't get in a rut, so to speak. I think that people that come from a trout fishing background kind of get in the rut with fishing streamers and particularly woolly boogers, which are very, very popular and very effective patterns, of always stripping it the same way, you know, a 6-inch strip or an 8-inch strip, and always kind of the same pace. You don't want to do that with temperate bass because their mood or their metabolism could dictate how they will lock onto a fly and attack it. Sometimes slow doesn't attract them. They might come and take a look and no. Or it might be too fast if the water's too cold or if it's too muddy or too dark. They lose track of it. They lose visible track of it. But there's just a lot of variables there that people need to be aware of. And it's the same if they happen to be coming from a spinning and gear fishing background, with crankbaits and different, you know, spinners and that kind of thing. They know that retrieve rates and those kinds of things and water temperatures are all very important variables and factors in their success rate. So for those people that are making that transition, make that equation and understand that there are great similarities that they can apply.
Okay, great. Well, unfortunately, it's time to wrap things up here, Bill, and close things off, but I think we've got a good education, and I think what I've learned, as with other fish species and so forth, is, you know, finding and locating the fish is one of the key things, and once you do that, then the rest of it kind of falls into place as to what you need to do. But I know from the standpoint of lakes and so forth, they can be quite intimidating, and especially people that fish rivers or streams where you kind of know where fish are hanging. But the lakes are much more intimidating, but I think you've given them a great insights on where to find those fish, and that's the key thing. So,
well, we have a lot of tools to be able to locate fish other than just the stuff we talked about today with electronics and water temperature and all that kind of thing. So you just have to use all the resources that you have.
Great. Well, when we come back, we're going to be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine, and that $20 gift certificate courtesy of Front Range Anglers in Boulder, Colorado. So stick with us here and see if you win. Family Ties, that's T-Y-E-S, Family Ties is an organization which uses a shared interest in fly fishing and fly tying to enhance youth development and family relationships. They utilize resources in schools, communities, and businesses, and they invite your participation. Go to their website, www.familyties.com. That's family, T-Y-E-S.com. Family Ties, where every fish is a trophy and every kid is a hero. And just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the site tonight, please leave us some feedback on the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section on tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. It only takes a minute, and we sure appreciate it. Now it's time to give away our prizes. Now, the winners of our drawings are randomly selected from the show's registration database, and if you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late, but make sure you do so for our next show so you don't miss out on any chances at these great prizes that we have to offer. Now, if you're the lucky winner, we will contact you after the show and provide you with the information on how to receive your gift. So first, we're going to be giving away a one-year's membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And to learn more about the FFF, go to www.fedflyfishers.org, www.fedflyfishers.org. A great organization that surely needs your support. So if you don't win tonight, go join anyway. There's a lot of benefits. So the winner for that one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers is Sherry Harris. Sherry Harris in Indiana. So, Sherry, congratulations. I'm sure you're going to enjoy that membership. And if you do have a membership already, we'll get that extended for you. And congratulations. Now, we're going to give away 1 year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine, which you can learn more about at www.flyfusionmag.com. That's flyfusionmag.com. And our winner there is Patrick McElhone. Patrick McElhone in Georgia. So, Patrick, congratulations. I know you're going to enjoy this magazine. It's a well-done, beautiful, beautifully printed magazine. Lots of great photography. So, enjoy and congratulations. Well, now, Bill, it's time to give away a prize based upon our conversation. This is kind of the, and yes, Warren, he did say Crease Fly. Warren Davis was asking about Crease Fly. Yes, C-R-E-A-S-E Fly. Yes. So, Bill, we're going to ask a question. The question is, early in the show, Bill said there's a particular time of year that's a prime time of year to fish for white bass. What time of year is that? What season is that? Tell us, and we'll see if anybody gets this right here, Bill. So, checking now to see what answers, and the first person that gets the correct answer will win.
It's got to be the easiest question I've ever heard on this show.
Okay, well, I didn't get a season, but you tell me if this qualifies. The answer is, when the temperature is 55 and up and they move upstream early April to later May.
Absolutely.
Okay. Which is called
and I would say
spring,
that
right?
Anywhere in the country, the month of April is a great month anywhere, even though latitudes and water temperatures change. Yeah.
Yeah. So, Warren, you just got yourself, Warren Davis, just got yourself a $20 gift certificate courtesy of Front Range Anglers in Boulder, Colorado. And if anybody wants to visit their site and sign up for their great newsletter as well, they have a great online newsletter. It's www.frontrangeanglers.com, frontrangeanglers.com in Boulder, Colorado. So, Warren, we'll get you that. I see you supplied your information here. I'll need your email address as well, so you might want to send that over to me, and then we'll send you your certificate by email, and you can read any of that online, or come visit us in Colorado. So, Warren happens to live in Ohio. So, terrific. Congratulations. Well, Bill, hey, again, appreciate you being on the show with us. You always give us an in-depth interview, and you succeeded in that again. We truly learned a lot about white bass, and you can open the eyes of some people about another fish they can go after. So, thanks for being with us tonight.
Well, you're quite welcome. I enjoyed it very much. And just remember, everybody out there, that it's only about 3 months till this starts to develop again for the spring fishing, which is the best time of year.
Great, great. Good to know. And if you don't live there, if you're passing through, hey, you know, check it out. Ask locals and find out where the white bass are and give it a try. Well, our next broadcast will be on December 16th at 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And on that show, we'll be interviewing Earl Waters. And our topic for the show will be how to get a grand slam in the salt. Earl Waters has achieved over 300 grand slams in the salt for his clients and himself, so he knows his stuff. Find out from Earl how to land a tarpon, permit, and bonefish all in one day. Well, we'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, the Platte River Fly Shop, Women's Fly Fishing in Alaska, Flats Time Charters, Pierre Marquette River Lodge for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would like to benefit sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-888-961-1115, extension 2. That's 888-961-1115, extension 2. We'll be happy to explain the options to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.